much. I mean, I split the movie, The Dock, into three parts. Part one was the arrant vulgarity and banality of it, with the arms dealer making their statements about politicians and prostitutes, things like that. The bit where they showed a whole Saudi sultan being given a commercial airliner, and the banality of him painting it in his favourite American football colours. I mean, if I was a Man U supporter, I'd have liveried it up in red, for example. Then the second part is that it goes into the culture and the rationales which are given to enable this to happen, and the institutions that support that culture, which is what we've just basically watched. Now, I could not help but expand this documentary into history, and I place at the start point towards the civilization we have now reached, at the start of the transatlantic slave trade, because this was the first time an activity, slavery, has been known since the dawn of civilization, but this was the first time it was actually industrialized. Mm-hmm. And with the industrialization, you had to create a philosophy and a culture which enabled it to go on, fly in plain sight, with the support of ordinary people. And this is the bit that this documentary does so extremely well.
Well, that's a fascinating point.
I denounced the call to invade Iraq publicly. The New York Times issued me a formal written reprimand, which is what you get before you're fired under union rules to stop speaking out against the war. I'd been the Middle East bureau chief. I mean, I'd been in Iraq. I'd been 7 years in the Middle East. How can you come out of Gaza and not be angry? What's being done to those people? How can you come out of the Sudan, El Salvador, you know, dozens of other places I've been, and not be angry? I've seen the bodies of a lot of children, which I can't forget. You know, especially having done it for 20 years, and, you know, yeah. Dostoevsky said, hell is the inability to love, and that's what kills people. I fully get why people blow their brains out. It's really hell. And I don't use love as a kind of hallmark, schmaltzy, you know, we all gotta love each other. I'm saying that the only way you're healed from those experiences is by reestablishing a connection with that kind of power, with another human being. And if you can't do that, you don't survive. And I have friends who couldn't do it, and they're not here anymore.
Very emotional account there. Maria, do you get a sense from this documentary that there is a lot of frustration and a lack of support for these ongoing wars?
Well, there is, but the problem is, and what the governments do so insidiously, is to instill terror and fear into the populace. And so that gives them carte blanche to do what they want militarily. And so people sort of believe what the government tells them. And so we're in this vicious circle that correspondents, brave correspondents, like you've just seen, try to get the truth out there. And they're literally, you know, smacked down, and they try to gag them. And that's appalling, and it shouldn't happen, but it does, and it's still happening today.
And this reminds me, actually, Claire Short, former Labour politician, she says that the war on terror is sort of almost like a manufactured concept to keep this sort of perpetual wars, and it's sort of used as a scapegoat. Would you agree with that,
Tessa? Well, a marketing man's dream is a product that creates demand for itself. It becomes a perpetual motion machine, and you can't stop it. And I call this part of the documentary the state capture bit. That's the expression we actually use in South Africa for when private people latch onto the state and leech off it. Because that's what's happened with the arms companies and their lobbyists, is that actually they are running the state. And that's why that arms dealer can say that the politicians don't run anything. They're just more expensive than prostitutes. It's the banality of that. And I think that at the end, this documentary works because of the sense of outrage. It can fire up in people. Some people will also just feel, what's the point? I give up. We don't stand a chance. But many, many people will be outraged just by being able to join the dots of the fact that these private contractors have got a stranglehold on government. And actually what government does is as a result of what is profitable to the contractor. And some of the governments, of course, people are corrupt. Imagine the ANC taking that massive...
The African National Congress.
Yeah. Taking that massive kickback when hundreds of thousands of poor, ordinary Africans' lives could have been saved with retroviral drugs. Mm-hmm. But they went for that because the ANC wanted to stay in power.
Well, going back to the documentary and a really fascinating point you made, there's four main targets, I suppose, of the documentary seems to be the US, the UK, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. How are the four countries portrayed in this documentary, Maria, and how are they connected?
Well, they're not portrayed terribly well, really, because they're in it for the money. You've seen Blair, who brought in New Labour and was, the spiritual light here, who's going to bring all this hope, and yet, you know, he was in it for the money. He was getting, kickbacks and stuff, allegedly. But what was interesting there is that the influence that the Saudi royal family had on him, and where you have Prince Bandar come over and say, hold on, the serious fraud office, I believe. Having this investigation into these crimes, and they were getting very close to him. And he said, no, you need to stop this. Otherwise, we're going to remove the security and there's going to be blood on the streets of London. And then you have Blair turning round and basically the guy says, jump. And Blair says, well, how high, more or less? That's disgusting, really.
And he
got away with it. But then he was, Teflon Tony, nothing stuck to him. And it's the same with all the other countries. You know, what surprised me was that they didn't look at the drone warfare, and also cyber warfare, which is now becoming...
The documentaries in their own right.
Exactly, and we've probably covered that already. The thing is that all these countries, nothing kind of surprised me about it, that they were all interlinked. They don't come out very well from the documentary, and if you didn't think well of them, then it will compound what you thought. It's speaking to the converted, really.
Fiscal year 1999, 2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, 1.1 trillion missing. The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other.
$1 trillion $1 bills stacked high would reach nearly 68,000 miles into space, one-third of the way to the moon.
I got a phone call from the FBI saying that I was a target of a death threat. And that's what happens when you go against the big boys.
Who has the contracts today to make those systems communicate with each other? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them?
There are times that corporations do things they should not do, in which case they tend to be suspended for some period. There are times then that corporations can get out of the penalty box, if you will.
This company was never in the penalty box. If you could proceed to my second question, please.
I've forgotten what the second question was.
Individuals operating in the shadows and never having their names called are able to leverage the power of the military and the foreign policy apparatus for their own personal pecuniary ends.
What now? Who's the enemy? How do we justify? What better new enemy than an hypothetical, invisible enemy called the War on Terror?
Rumsfeld looked quite smug and incompetent there. Maria, I heard you laugh during that clip. Why was that?
Because he wasn't incompetent. He knew exactly what he was doing and he knew he could get away with it. And he has. It was the one that was then ostracized and found it very difficult later on in her career. So these people get away with it. That's the problem. And it's wrong. But what can you do? What can we do?
And Tete, would you agree with Maria? How do you think of how Rumsfeld was portrayed in this documentary, and was it accurate depiction?
Funny thing, when I was watching it, I actually thought it took me back to one of the scenes in the Godfather movies when the mafia bosses are lined up in front of a, I think it was a grand jury or a commission of some sort, and the smugness with which they behave literally said that whoever's asking the questions, I own your boss. So, and it's the confidence of knowing that they could, he could pull her leash in at any time that he wanted, and sure enough, she's got death threats by the FBI. Whether they're true or false, it's almost lethal pressure to make sure that these people comply. It's extremely difficult, but I actually feel that you can over-egg the pudding to a point. And with the confluence of certain events in world affairs, the nationalism that's rising in Europe, Brexit that's happened in Britain, Trump and all the excesses that he is associated with, I think actually we have reached a turning point in which many of these old ways will not be able to function in the way they did before.
So this documentary raises greater and greater questions and makes us question society. Do you think this is a testament to the documentary then, Maria?
I think so. Like I said earlier, it doesn't really reveal anything new, but
it's certainly thought-provoking.
But it's thought-provoking and it makes you think, and it kind of joins all the dots, basically, because we knew all this. But when you see it there in black and white or in colour, it's slightly different. And it does make you really angry. You know, you end up screaming at the screen because it's so frustrating that these people, on the face of it, got away with it. And
sorry, just a final thoughts on the film?
But you see, the interesting thing is that there is another documentary that follows this, which will have to put the last piece of the jigsaw in place, which is that actually our collective standard of living is built on the excesses we're seeing in this movie. And it is, I think, when that story is told, that people will connect the fact that actually there isn't so much of an otherness around somebody who behaves like a gangster in creating public policy, and the car that I'm driving on the street, and the fact that my salary is what it is. All of this thing has a cyclical kind of connection, and people will start to join those dots as well.
A very powerful note to end it on, and I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there as we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you both to my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی است.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3rd, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq. Greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master and Prophet, Abul Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad, and upon his pure, immaculate, chosen, and infallible household, especially the one remaining with Allah on earth. I wish to congratulate all viewers, all the people of Iran, and the entire great Islamic Ummah on the auspicious birthday anniversary of the Holy Prophet and the great messenger, God's greetings be upon him and his household, and the birthday anniversary of Hadhrat Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace and greetings be upon him. This is a great Eid. This holy birthday prepared the ground for the Holy Prophet's Bi'tha, and his Bi'tha has been the greatest historic event for humanity from the beginning to the end. I hope that this Eid will be a joyous occasion for our dear people, the dear Iranian nation, all Muslim nations, and the great Islamic Ummah. I hope that it will have many blessings for the human community, God willing.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Today, there are three occasions. One is this auspicious and great birthday anniversary, that of the Holy Prophet and his holy progeny, Hadhrat Sadiq, peace and greetings be upon him. Another is Unity Week, which is a very important occasion. And the last is the 13th of Aban, which is the day of fighting against arrogance. There are many ayahs in the Holy Quran about the Holy Prophet, God's greetings be upon him and his household. Some of these ayahs clearly manifest humanity's condition in the present time. When one reads these ayahs, one feels as if they had been sent down for today's humanity. One ayah is from Holy Surah Al-Bara'ah. Now has come unto you a messenger from among yourselves. It grieves him that you should perish. Ardently anxious is he over you. To the believers, he is most kind and merciful. The Holy Quran, chapter 9, verse 128. The first two sentences of the ayah are related to the entire humanity. There is another ayah which says, O men, I am sent unto you all as the messenger of Allah. The Holy Quran, chapter 7, verse 158. The entire humanity is addressed by the Holy Prophet in this ayah. These two sentences are very important.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. To Allah.
got debate.
Hello, welcome to The Debate. I'm Kava Tatwe. When it comes to the U.S. troop withdrawal, well, it is never a complete withdrawal. From the recent announcements of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and Iraq to their previous withdrawal announcements, there always appears to be, well, a small contingent that is left over. But why? Like in the case of Iraq, which not only MPs but many Iraqis actually want the U.S. to withdraw its troops from the country completely. The U.S. troop withdrawal is the subject of this edition of The Debate. Let me introduce our guests. We have James Dutras, who's a former U.S. Senate foreign policy analyst, joining us from Washington, D.C. We also have Michael Springman, who's an author and former diplomat, also joining us from Washington, D.C. James Dutras, let me first start with you. The Pentagon has said that the U.S. will slash troop levels in Afghanistan and in Iraq to the lowest levels in nearly 20 years of war after President Donald Trump pledged to end the conflicts abroad. Your reaction to that, and why it is that they are going to still, the U.S. is still going to leave a small contingent of troops in the countries, both countries.
Well, as we know, President Trump has suggested many times he wants to get American troops out of Afghanistan, Iraq, and also Syria. As far as I know, we haven't heard anything about Syria in these in the latest announcements. And we know that he's been met every step of the way with a great deal of opposition from the bipartisan establishment. And even these reductions, not even a complete withdrawal, as you say, have been met almost with hysteria by the establishment. So we'll see if he's even able to manage to do that. But you're right. I think he's probably doing about as much as he thinks he can do toward a complete withdrawal. And even that, even these reductions, I think are still a big fat question mark, assuming that he's going to be leaving office in January. Can he even get that done between now and then? So far, his track record has not been good.
Well, we know that there are Afghan peace talks that are going on, Michael Springman, if you want to call them any type of peace talks that are making any type of progress. I'd like to get your reaction on what the Taliban spokesman has said. Quote, it is a good step, the announcement of the troop withdrawal, and it's in the interest of the people of both countries that the sooner the foreign forces leave, the more the war will be prevented. If that's the case, and if you agree with him, first of all, then why hasn't the U.S. And other foreign forces left Afghanistan at this point?
Well, I agree with the Taliban spokesman. The Taliban's position all along has been to get foreign forces out of their country. Yet the Americans and the Europeans, the NATO, the defensive alliance has somehow turned into an offensive one, are still there, and there are about 7,000 of them, and there is a question as to any of them will be leaving or not. You've got the excuses being given by the so-called foreign policy establishment, the people who've supported wars and invasions and so forth over the years, as being horrified that, oh, we won't be able to control terrorism. We have to have people there to deal with these people. Well, I think the whole point of the opposition to the American occupation of the various countries in the region is terrorism. People are fighting for their homeland and fighting to get the Imperial stormtroopers out of their country and send them back home. Nothing is said at all about the roughly 100,000 other U.S. servicemen in the area, nor the 300,000 or more in Europe, nor the 50-odd thousand in Japan. They focus on a couple of countries, cutting the forces by 2,500 in Afghanistan and maybe 500 in Iraq, and not a word about the 1,000 or so, if not more, helping steal the oil from the Syrian government. So it's a whole shell game, I guess you want to call it. Hide the peanut, what do you want to do with this stuff? Not one word is said about the $1 billion worth of American military equipment stored in Israel, nor how many servicemen are actually serving in Israel at the present time. So it's focusing on a small item at the expense of a large item. It's ignoring the elephant in the room, so to speak.
The opposition has come on this, James Dutras. Let's focus on it's coming about the withdrawal, U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. Germany has stated, we are particularly concerned over what the U.S. announcement could mean for the continuation of peace talks in that country. This comes from the German foreign minister. But when you take a look at the opposition in the case of Afghanistan, hasn't the U.S. had enough time in that country? 19 years they have spent there, along with foreign forces.
Well, yes, 19 years, and we've been in Korea for how many decades, and in Japan and Germany for how many decades? I think the rule here is that whatever the excuse is, that they come up with an ad hoc basis, whether it's stopping terrorism. Of course, as we know, in many countries like Syria, we've been supporting the terrorists, like we did in Libya, whether it's to help women's rights or to prevent instability, or whether it's to counter the Russians or the Chinese or keep an eye on Pakistan and their nuclear weapons. All these excuses are ad hoc excuses toward one end, and that is no place that American boots have ever been on the ground will they ever be withdrawn. And that seems to be the consensus of the American bipartisan establishment, is that we are not in these forever wars because we are trying to achieve some objectives. Those objectives keep changing. The goalposts keep changing. What is the constant is that we don't ever want these forces to be withdrawn, because especially in a place like Afghanistan, which is probably one of the hardest places to get American forces into, as a strategic footprint in Central Asia, once we're out, maybe it's not so easy to get back in. So the establishment never wants to relinquish that foothold, and they'll just keep up coming up with as many excuses as they need to for another 19 years, another 19 years, another 19 years.
Okay, last question about Afghanistan at this point, I think, Michael Springman, and we'll go on to another country. And this particular expose was revealed by the Washington Post back in the year 2019 that revealed that senior U.S. officials failed to tell the truth about the war throughout the 19-year campaign, making rosy pronouncements that they knew were false and hiding unmistakable evidence that the war was unwinnable. And it was known for years that this was the case. So with this, and they had confessions from senior military officials within this revelation that the Washington Post made in that year. Given that fact and that track record, how is it that the U.S. then wants to convince Americans that it should continue and prolong these wars?
Well, it goes back to Vietnam. The Americans were lying about what was happening there, that the war can be won next week, we just have more men and so forth. They ignored the actual facts on the ground there. But they want to convince the Americans that American soldiers are needed in Afghanistan and elsewhere, simply because if the American people start to think about how much money and how many lives are being wasted, not only American ones, but God knows how many Afghan ones, the Americans might think twice about permitting their government to engage in foreign escapades at the expense of vast sums of money, vast quantities of life, and a totally useless action that is not winnable and should not be winnable in the first place. The American soldiers should never have been there to begin with 20 years ago.
Now let's move on to Iraq. James Dutras, you have Iraq and also Afghanistan, in which they have said, for example, Afghanistan's national security spokesperson, that the forces there are already, the Afghan security and defense forces are already conducting 96% of the operations independently in that country to defend it against the enemies. If you have the Afghan National Security Forces saying that, and in Iraq also, you have the Iraqi army that says that they can take care of, for example, the fight against terrorism, against the Daesh terrorists, then why is the U.S. insisting on staying on?
As I say, this is part of simply a pattern of the American establishment. We never want to leave any place we've ever been in. And one of the ironies, of course, is we keep saying we're there to bring democracy to these countries. We overthrew Saddam Hussein to bring democracy to Iraq, and now that they have something like a democracy and a parliament that says they want us out, well, that doesn't count, though. That's not the kind of democracy we're talking about. Look, I don't know what else to say on this front. It's window dressing, that the goal is global domination. These are footholds where we can strategically try to box in powers we don't like. Obviously, if you look at both Iraq and Afghanistan, what's right in between them? Iran. And so this is part of our strategic boxing in Iran, and also putting pressure on Russia, China, the Belt and Road Initiative, and so forth. And we'll come up with any excuse we want to And, of course, our stated goals like democracy are simply wouldn't address it.
So when it comes to the reasons, Michael Springman, of the U.S. staying, obviously for them to have personnel on the ground in their bases is one of those reasons. However, we're seeing in the case of Iraq, Afghanistan also, but in the case of Iraq, that things have somewhat changed since the U.S. assassination of General Qasem Soleimani. And the response that Iran gave to the U.S. After that assassination. Do you think in that respect, then the U.S. decided at this point for the further decrease of their troops in that country down to, well, they say 2,500, but it could be as low as 500. It all depends, again, how you look at it, what source you have.
Well, from what I've seen, they're talking only about removing 500 servicemen from Iraq. And supposedly they want to keep them there to fight terrorists. And as Professor Edmund Gharib, the Washington, D.C. expert on the region, said, and I quoted my book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, there was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq until the American invasion. So I think it's another specious example of why the Americans justify continuing to occupy a country with which we are not at war. Again, it's a continuation of this building a ring of fire around Iran that will not be removed. You've got bases stretching all the way around the country, through the Gulf and up into Afghanistan, and westward to Jordan and so forth. So I think that it's basically for American political purposes to control the region, American economic purposes. You have soldiers overseas, you need to equip them, you need to pay them, you need to send them weapons, you need to send them ammunition, and it's jobs for the boys back in the United States amongst the big defense contractors. So everybody benefits except the people who are being occupied.
Okay, somewhat of this focus is obviously, James Dutras, on the U.S. military and its personnel. We know that China is ranking very high on the list of the U.S. in terms of the way that it's dealing with it in the South China Sea, for example, crisis. What is your take on the pivot that started when Obama was in power in the year 2014 towards China and to where it has escalated now? Are we looking at troop deployment into that area on a faster scale, and yet having some troop drawdowns in places, as they have announced, Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, I'm not sure about the second part, because as I said, I'm skeptical that these drawdowns will occur. I would not necessarily make that a one-to-one. We withdraw from the Middle East and put them against China. I think probably they will stay in the Middle East, and then they will also be deployed against China, that we will simply continue to crank up the war machine against Iran, against China, against Russia, maybe against Venezuela, who knows. And I think that's irrespective of whether Trump somehow manages to hang on to office or whether Biden and his team of warmongers come in. There's been some speculation that maybe because Biden is compromised by his son's relationship, business relationship with the Chinese, that he would go easy on them. Frankly, I think that we'll probably see stepped up anti-China steps in rhetoric and deployments in the South China Sea, the Taiwan Strait, and so forth. And to the extent that Biden feels that he is vulnerable politically on that front, he'll probably do the same thing that Trump did on the accusations that he was a puppet of Vladimir Putin. Nobody's been tougher on the Russians than I've been. And I'm sure that my guess is that Biden will try to tout how tough he is on the Chinese to show that he has no such compromises that he has to be worried about. I don't think it's an either-or proposition, though, that we will continue a full-court press against perceived enemies in many regions of the world.
So our guest, James Dutras, called it the Biden warmonger team. Michael Springman, tell us why he would say that and how his approach would be towards having troops, for example, in the West Asia region, like in Iraq and in Afghanistan.
Well, from what I've seen in various articles written by McGovern and Phil Giraldi, both with the CIA, formerly with the CIA, and another fellow whose name I can't recall at the moment, Biden apparently is bringing in the Obama neocon team, you've got Samantha Power being suggested as Secretary of State, Michelle Flournoy as Secretary of Defense, sending Hillary Clinton to the United Nations as ambassador there, along with Susan Rice, and other people who Victoria Nuland, the architect of the disaster in the Ukraine, to bring it back the old crowd, and they're going to again give the impression that, oh yes, we're for peace and truth, justice, and what used to be the American way, and it's going to be more of the same. It will be no difference between Trump and Obama and Biden and Clinton and the Bush crime syndicate. And of course, they're going to continue Obama's pivot to the Far East to try and contain China, no matter what it costs, no matter if it sparks a conflict with these American incursions into Chinese territorial waters and into the sprinkle of islands in Southeast Asia that are claimed by four or five or six different countries. So I see nothing but trouble ahead.
What about Syria, James Jatras? We know that Trump, when he did a troop drawdown there, he got lots of flack for his decision, even to this day. Country said no, it was the wrong move by the U.S. And it almost seemed like, in response, he left a small contingent to guard those oil fields, which we now know that it's being used, the revenues is being used, and not to the Syrian government, obviously. What's going to be the approach there from here on? And of course, given that Trump may end up leaving, we still don't know. As the media reports, he could be on his way out with the new president-elect coming in.
That's right. Well, to start with, let's remember, I think maybe Trump, who's probably not the most discerning person in the world regarding his subordinates, was maybe conned on this silly notion of we have to stay there to guard Syria's oil. But in fact, we know that James Jeffrey, the former envoy for Syria, has openly admitted that they lied to the president about how many troops were really in Syria and that they were hiding the numbers from him so that our presence there was actually much bigger than the president thought it was. I think Syria, in all likelihood, if the Biden team comes in, will suddenly flare up again. Because remember, these are the people who, back under the Obama administration, after their great success in Libya with regime change there, they became the biggest supporters of al-Qaeda and its offshoots in Syria to overthrow the legitimate government of Syria under Bashar al-Assad. And I think they will go back to that script, that since Trump has not managed to get us out of the Syria business, there's still that toehold there, and these people will come back with a vengeance to try to complete the work that they started in 2011 to keep that war going, to flare it up again, start deploying again these terrorist assets, and double down on regime change in Syria. So that's what I think that's a very predictable spot we can watch blow up once these people come back into their own.
Michael Springman, so therefore that may give perhaps some truth to how the U.S. uses, for example, Iraq to funnel troops into Syria for operations there. But do you agree with that assessment made there by James Jatras in terms of how Syria may become front and center again for the possibly incoming administration of Joe Biden?
Yes, I do. And I would add that it would be another chance for the Biden administration, that in fact comes in, to look to attack Iran, because Iran has been providing advisors and supplies to the legitimate Syrian government forces, and assisting the Russians, helping to combat the American terrorists that they imported and have been supplying with weapons, training, and so forth ever since.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. That was Michael Springman, author and former diplomat there from Washington, D.C., and also James Jatras. Thank you, former U.S. Senate Foreign Policy Analyst, also from Washington, D.C. And that does it for this edition of The Debate. Let me cover it that way. It's goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
The limelight.
While people today are getting older and older, diseases that are associated with age, for example, cardiovascular diseases, cancer, dementia, and diabetes, are also increasing. Reaching late life while staying healthy is of high priority. Recently, the drug metformin, which has been used for decades to treat patients suffering from type 2 diabetes, was linked to the reduced risk of cancer development and showed potential to alleviate cardiovascular diseases in humans. Furthermore, a life-prolonging effect of metformin has recently been shown in mice, flies, and worms. So, does this make metformin the new miracle drug to prolong life and even delay aging-associated diseases? The first clinical testing of a potential life-prolonging effect of metformin in aged humans without diabetes has been initiated by the American Federation for Aging Research. However, the long-term effects of metformin in a non-diabetic cohort at different age have not been investigated yet. We now present you an article written by researchers at the Leibniz Institute on Aging under the heading Age Decisive for Positive or Negative Effects of Diabetes Drug Metformin. The article has appeared on the front page of MedicalExpress.com website. Please stay with us for more. Metformin is a common type 2 diabetes drug. Recently, it was found to extend lifespan of young non-diabetic animals, but the responses of older organisms to metformin remains unexplored. Researchers at the Leibniz Institute on Aging, Fritz Lippmann Institute in Jena, Germany, and the Friedrich Schiller University in Jena in Germany found that mitochondrial dysfunction abrogates metformin benefits in aged C. elegans and late passage human cells. Moreover, the same metformin regime that prolongs the lifespan of young nematodes was toxic in old animals by inducing deleterious metabolic changes. These findings suggest that aging sets a limit for the health span benefits of metformin outside of diabetes. While people today are getting older and older, diseases that are associated with age, such as cardiovascular diseases, cancer, dementia, and diabetes, are also increasing. Reaching late life while staying healthy is of high priority. Recently, the drug metformin, which has been used for decades to treat patients suffering from type 2 diabetes, was linked to the reduced risk of cancer development and showed potential to alleviate cardiovascular diseases in humans. Furthermore, a life-prolonging effect of metformin has recently been shown in mice, in flies, and worms. So does this make metformin the new miracle drug to prolong life and even delay aging-associated diseases? The first clinical testing of a potential life-prolonging effect of metformin in aged humans without diabetes has been initiated by the American Federation for Aging Research. However, the long-term effects of metformin in a non-diabetic cohort at different age have not been investigated as yet. Researchers at the Leibniz Institute on Aging, the Fritz Lippmann Institute in Jena, Germany, and their colleagues from the Friedrich Schiller University in Jena, Germany, have now addressed these questions. They used the nematode C. elegans and human primary cells to investigate the metabolic response of young and old non-diabetic organisms to metformin treatment in detail. The current study has now been published in the journal Nature Metabolism. Metformin affects blood glucose levels by increasing the effect of the body's own insulin, and it is currently the most frequently prescribed drug for type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is an aging-related disease, and many patients begin metformin treatment at an advanced age. Based on the increased survival and reduced prevalence of aging-associated diseases in diabetes patients under metformin treatment, it was proposed that the longevity benefits of metformin could be extended to metabolically healthy older people. Dr. Maria Ermoleva, head of the Junior Research Group Stress Tolerance and Homeostasis at FLI, said, "Upon discovering the life-prolonging effects of metformin in metabolic healthy worms and mice, a real hype arose about this diabetes drug as a possible miracle medicine against aging." She added, her group uses the nematode C. elegans as well as mammalian cell cultures and the short-lived turquoise killifish to identify changes in metabolism and stress responses during aging. Dr. Ermoleva said, "In our current study, we were able to uncover important limitations for the use of metformin as longevity medicine. In contrast to the positive longevity effects in young organisms that receive metformin, lifespan is shortened through metformin intake at an older age. Previous studies that provided evidence of an extended longevity by metformin usually examined animals treated with metformin from young adult or middle age until the end of life." Dr. Ermoleva added, "In contrast, we have looked at treatment windows covering the entire lifespan or restricted to early life or to late life." The study also utilized the human cell culture model to replicate aging to assess human responses to metformin at a cellular level and compare them to organismal responses of the worms. The research team led by Dr. Ermoleva found that the very same metformin treatment that prolonged life when C. elegans worms were treated at young age was highly toxic when animals of old age were treated. Up to 80% of the population treated at old age were killed by metformin within the first 24 hours of treatment. Consistently, human primary cells demonstrated a progressive decrease in metformin tolerance as they approached replicative senescence. The researchers were able to link this detrimental phenotype to the reduced ability of old cells and old nematodes to adapt to metabolic stressors like metformin. Under these circumstances, the exact same dose of the drug that increased longevity of young-treated organisms by triggering adaptive stress responses was harmful in animals treated at old age, which were unable to activate such protective signals. Using proteome and lipid metabolism analysis, the team showed that metformin treatment initiated at an advanced age induces a cascade of metabolic failures culminating in lethal mitochondrial decline, exhaustion of ATP, and ultimately in cell death. Interestingly, the toxic effect of metformin in old animals was reduced by simultaneous administration of rapamycin, an immunosuppressive drug found by the authors to stabilize the ATP levels in metformin-treated cells, a possibility to alleviate metformin toxicity in older organisms, an advanced idea of metformin as an anti-aging drug. Dr. Ermoleva explains, our study performed in C. elegans and human primary fibroblasts shows that there is an age-related decrease in metformin tolerance, which in later life leads to toxicity of all metformin doses tested. This shows possible safety risks of late-life administration of metformin to individuals without diabetes. About the results, Dr. Ermoleva says, our data raises serious questions about the suitability of metformin as an anti-aging drug for older individuals without diabetes. This work links the reversal of metformin benefits in late life to a decline of key metabolic activities, mitochondria, glycolysis, lipid turnover in older animals, describing the unique molecular and genetic mechanism of the age-specific adverse effects of metformin. It underlines the emerging importance of personalized approaches to longevity treatments and warrants further detailed studies in mammals to probe the suitability of metformin as an intervention to promote healthy aging in non-diabetic humans.